Welcome to China in Context. I'm Duncan Bartlett. What's the most delicious wine from Australia? Could it be the much-prized Block 42 Cabernet Sauvignon made by Penfolds, bottled back in about 2004? A single bottle of that Grand Cru sold at auction for $168,000. I wonder if Penfolds has something equally special in mind for a Chinese leader who, it's rumoured, could make an official visit to Australia later this year. Might that person be Xi Jinping? It could be that before he makes such a trip, Mr. Xi removes the tariffs on Australian wine, which is imported into China. But even though the wine trade might celebrate, not everyone in Australia is enthusiastic about this proposed visit. On today's podcast, we'll be hearing why stabilising relations between China and Australia remains a somewhat controversial idea, and one that could cause tension between Australia and its key security partner, the United States. I'm very pleased to welcome back a very knowledgeable and articulate guest. James Lawrenson is Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology in Sydney. James, good to have you with us again.
Good to be back, Duncan.
Well, let's start with the wine. Penfolds is one of Australia's oldest wineries, but that very expensive Block 42 wine I mentioned is not actually that old. It was launched at about the same time that Mr. Xi became China's leader. Just remind us why Australian wine was taken off the menu in China.
Yeah, look, we can probably go back to April 2020 for the start of things. Political relations were plummeting at the time, and an Australian journalist asked the then Chinese ambassador whether trade restrictions, sanctions could be on the way. And the ambassador replied that Chinese consumers might well start thinking, quote, why they should drink Australian wine or eat Australian beef, close quote. And shortly after that, Australian exports to China began being disrupted, starting with barley and beef. In August that year, the Chinese Commerce Ministry announced it would launch an anti-dumping investigation into Australian wine. In October, coal, cotton, timber, lobster were all hit. And then finally, on November 28th that year, the investigation that was announced a few months earlier concluded that Australian wine was indeed being dumped and that Australian producers were beneficiaries of unfair subsidies as well. So in response, Beijing imposed tariffs of between 107 and 212%, depending on the company, essentially wiping out a trade worth around about $1 billion. Now, more than 3 years later, those tariffs are still in place, but just last November, following a WTO dispute case brought by Canberra, Beijing said that it had agreed to review the tariffs, and the expectation right now is that later this month they'll finally be removed.
Well, let's talk about the Australian side of things. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has said it's in Australia's interests to have good relations with China. Mr. Albanese went to Beijing. He had a face-to-face meeting with Xi Jinping last year. And I noticed that in February 2024, the Prime Minister joined an Australian Chinese community party for a big dinner to celebrate the Lunar New Year. So, in fact, the Chinese ambassador to Australia, Xiao Jian, was also there. What do you think that Mr. Albanese's diplomatic objectives are for the Year of the Dragon?
Since winning government in May 2022, the catch cry of the Albanese government's diplomatic objective towards China has been, quote unquote, stabilization. It's actually an objective that seems to have caught on a bit recently. I see US President Joe Biden adopting it as well. Look, I think we can expect more of the same this year. The goal is to keep political relations stable, if not as warm as they were 10 years ago. And the hope that is at least if political relations are stable and not spiraling downwards as they were during the previous government, then trade, people-to-people exchanges, all those parts of the bilateral relationship that Canberra still very much assesses to be in the national interest, that they can proceed. And even the Prime Minister's critics have to acknowledge that most of the disruptive trade measures that Beijing imposed in 2020 have now been removed. All that remains is the tariffs on wine and some quarantine technicalities that's still preventing rock lobsters from re-entering the Chinese market. We've gone from around $20 billion worth of trade restrictions to around $1 to $2 billion today. It's perhaps also worth noting that while the Australian government remains content with stabilisation, the current Chinese ambassador has publicly stated that he hopes the two countries can aspire to something more ambitious. But you can kind of understand why Canberra has been hesitant. I mean, not all of the trade restrictions have been removed. So in a sense, we still haven't quite got back to square one, where things were at the end of 2019, even if things are vastly improved compared with a couple of years ago. And, you know, frankly, Beijing's foreign policy behavior continues to make managing the domestic politics pretty difficult for the government. Last November, for example, a People's Liberation Army Navy vessel in the East China Sea injured some Australian divers when it deployed some powerful sonar pulses in their direction. So, you know, given that, if the Prime Minister started talking up the China relationship too broadly or without any qualifications and caveats, then the political attacks that would come from the opposition are pretty predictable.
Well, look, James, I agree with you that both Australia and the United States are now talking quite often about stabilizing relations with China. But there does seem to be a different tone when it comes to issues of security and defence. And I noticed that warships from Australia joined those from the United States and Japan for joint drills in the South China Sea recently. How do you square that kind of operation with these more friendly diplomatic overtures towards China?
Yeah, it's a good question, Duncan. And it's one that Beijing actually asks all the time. You know, does Australia consider China a partner and a friend or a competitor and a threat? And to be sure, there's, you know, plenty in Australia who ask the same questions, and not just China doves either. I mean, Australia's China hawks will argue that, you know, the government is being inconsistent too. For them, China is not a friend. And so why pretend that it is in the diplomatic space? My own view is that the government has got this one right. You know, for Australia's interest, China is not a binary. Right? It's a spectrum presenting, you know, a full range of opportunities and challenges, and managing these challenges in a way that allows for the opportunities to continue to be reaped is precisely what diplomacy was invented for. And I think the evidence is compelling that this is largely what's being achieved right now. And look, even in that defense and security space, when it comes to the AUKUS agreement, for example, I don't think we should confidently conclude that Canberra is now heading in a hard anti-China direction. I mean, for decades, literally decades, Canberra's taken a two-pronged approach to managing China relations. On the one hand, it's consistently welcomed, and still does today, China's economic rise, and it's supported people-to-people and business engagement with it. On the other, it's recognised that there was always a possibility that one day China might convert that increased prosperity to military assertiveness in a way that threatens Australia's interests. And so some balancing in the defence realm was prudent. In 2009, for example, leaked US diplomatic cables say that then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd told Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that the focus on naval capability in that year's defence white paper was, quote, a response to China's growing ability to project force, close quote. So, you know, don't get me wrong, AUKUS is a significant initiative, but put in that broader context, it's not something that's, you know, inconsistent with Australia's long-standing approach. And I mean, I actually think that if Beijing's behavior in the East China Sea, the South China Sea, towards Taiwan and so on, had been more conciliatory over the past decade, then it's entirely possible that AUKUS may not even exist today.
Well, thank you. That's a very nuanced answer, which helps us to understand how those two aspects of foreign policy fit together. I want to talk to you about another issue. Yang Jun, a writer, he's a Chinese-born Australian citizen, and he's been in jail since 2019 on spying allegations, which he has denied. He says that he's been tortured at a secret detention site, He's expressed fear that forced confessions may be used against him. In fact, he's under a death sentence, although there are signs that might be commuted to life imprisonment. I suppose that's a concession of sorts. But surely there must be a concern that China is using its criminal justice system to lash out against someone who may well be innocent, or indeed may simply be a critic of the Chinese communist system.
Oh, indeed, of course. And look, the Australian government hasn't minced their words on Yong Heng Jun's case. Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, called the decision, quote unquote, appalling. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said that the government had conveyed to Beijing, quote, our dismay, our despair, our frustration, but to put it really simply, our outrage at this verdict, closed quote. The Chinese ambassador was also called in to, you know, face the music from the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Now, at the same time, when the foreign minister was asked whether Beijing would take, whether Canberra would take more dramatic measures, such as recalling our own ambassador to China or rescinding an invitation for a Chinese leader visit this year, she quite quickly hosed down those sorts of suggestions. And at the same time, our trade minister, Don Farrell, has continued talking up that part of the bilateral relationship. I mean, just last week, he met the Chinese Commerce Ministry on the sidelines of the World Trade Organization ministerial, and emerged from that meeting saying that there was no reason why a $300 billion two-way trade relationship couldn't become a $400 billion one. But yes, I do think, you know, Yong's case will shrink Canberra's appetite for embracing initiatives with Beijing that might signal a desire to move beyond that diplomatic objective of stabilization.
James, what role does Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong have in managing the relationship with China?
Oh, look, she's driving Australia's approach to China relations, no doubt. The Prime Minister trusts her. And don't forget that she was shadow foreign minister in opposition for 6 years before the Labor Party won the election in May 2022. So she came into the job well prepared and with some well-considered views around that relationship. In April 2023, she gave a speech at the National Press Club where she said very matter-of-factly that, quote, like any country, China will deploy its strength and utilize this influence to advance its interests, close quote. And accordingly, she said, quote, we need not waste energy with shock or outrage at China seeking to maximize its advantage. Instead, we channel our energy in pressing for our own advantage, close quote.
I wonder whether Australia is in a stronger position with China than many other democracies because of its thriving economy. I noticed actually that two-way trade between the nations hit another record high in 2023, and there are also obviously very many fruitful people-to-people exchanges. So I can totally understand the impulse to be friendly and to stabilize the relationship, as you put it. But I also wonder if there's, how can I put it, a certain naivety about the way the Albanese government is handling China?
Rather than naivety, I think it stems more from a well-grounded confidence. I mean, there are certainly plenty of critics who continue to say that the government isn't doing enough to reduce the dependence of the Australian economy on China. But what has the experience over the last couple of years been? I mean, in 2020, stretching into 2022, Beijing hit Australia with an unprecedented campaign of trade disruptions. But the impact was, well, in terms of economic harm and certainly in terms of broader international reputation, I think it harmed China more than it harmed Australia. You know, we know Beijing didn't hit those goods that Chinese importers couldn't easily get from elsewhere, like iron ore, LNG, lithium, wool, wheat, and so on. This meant that at an aggregate level, as you noted, trade kept hitting new record highs. And so I don't think Canberra is naive about the challenges that Beijing still presents, including with respect to coercive economic measures, but rather it's reassured that the economy remains resilient even in the face of these. And that's not a bad position to be in.
Well, James, thank you so much for your thoughtful analysis of these issues surrounding international relations. And I hope that you'll join us again soon to talk to us more about how things develop. That was James Laurenson, the director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology in Sydney. This podcast is produced by the SOAS China Institute, part of the University of London. And you can find out more about our courses and research at soas.ac.uk. But for now, that's all from us here at the China in Context podcast team.